You're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIPC.
Welcome back, Indianapolis, to another edition of Saturday Night on the Circle. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule to spend it with me, your host, Ethan Hatcher, and producer Carl. Beep, 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 pushing those buttons and doing the things to make the show possible over on the board and doing an excellent job as usual. Thank you, Carl. We got a lot to discuss on this week's show. Of course, some of the most prominent headlines this week included new shocking and dismaying footage from the Uvalde school shooting, in which officers dithered while school children screamed in terror, playing on their phones and washing their hands with hand sanitizer in a truly disgusting display, highlighting the abject failure of law enforcement response in that instance. Of course, we also had the saga of the 10-year-old rape victim mentioned in Joe Biden's address after he signed the executive order protecting abortion access last week on Friday. He mentioned that, and there's been ongoing developments. We're going to get into that in the first segment. And then also talking about abortion, there were hearings in the Senate and in the House dealing with the impact from the overturn of Roe versus Wade in the states, entertaining exchanges involving Josh Hawley as well as John Cornyn. Stay tuned for that later in the show. Saturday Night on the Circle, 93 WIBC. We begin, of course, with that unfortunate story which broke July 1st in the Indianapolis Star about a 10-year-old rape victim. OBGYN Dr. Caitlin Bernard told the Indianapolis Star that she was contacted by a child abuse doctor in neighboring Ohio, and she helped a 10-year-old have an abortion here in Indiana, and the girl was 6 weeks and 3 days into pregnancy, which would have made it illegal in Ohio due to the trigger law that was passed there, illegal, making abortions past 6 weeks illegal. During a speech on July 8th was when this story started to get most national traction, when Joe Biden signed the executive order protecting access to abortion services, and he mentioned this little girl to emphasize its importance.
Just last week was reported that a 10-year-old girl was a rape victim in Ohio, 10 years old. And she was forced to have to travel out of the state to Indiana to seek to terminate the pregnancy and maybe save her life. That's last part is my judgment. 10 years old. 10 years old. Raped, 6 weeks pregnant, already traumatized, was forced to travel to another state. Imagine being that little girl. Just imagine being that little girl, 10 years old.
Now, this story obviously was extremely shocking and developed very quickly. In fact, gained national attention before the perpetrator, the rapist, the accused rapist, alleged rapist, I should say, was ultimately arrested. And in the days before the story was verified, members of conservative media outlets and Republican officials expressed doubt as to whether or not that this girl actually existed. And this was an exchange on Fox News Outnumbered, kind of encapsulating the doubts surrounding that story in the days after it broke.
If they cared about this and that 10-year-old, they could at least say, you know what, we have verified the story. We are working to help that family, that sort of thing. But because they haven't come out and said that, they don't know where this came from either. I mean, we know that potentially it's not true.
Yeah, Corinne Jean-Pierre was asked about this. Have you independently verified the story? She didn't answer the question.
Yeah, and you know, not having evidence that it's not true is not evidence that it is true. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of where the media has gone today. And not to be glib mm-hmm. about it, but you know, this is what you get from people who look at Hispanic voters and see them all as tacos or something like that. Everyone, everything, there is no situation that these people are not willing to exploit. And, you know, nothing rivals the atrocity of a 10-year-old rape victim. But the idea that you would have politicians in America trying to exploit a story like this and make up a story like this in order to advance their own sick agenda tells you they're not serious about the issue, and they're not serious about the people who are affected by the issue. And you know, I think it sort of discredits them from the field of decent debate about it.
Yeah.
Now, it turns out those doubts were somewhat premature. And in fact, you don't have to manufacture tragedy in 2022 America. The same day that that Enlightened story aired on Tuesday, July 12th, Gerson Fuentes was arrested in Colombia, according to court documents. He was charged with felony rape of that minor under the age of 13, according to Franklin County Municipal Court. And his first court appearance was Wednesday. So it turns out that this sad story isn't so much exploitative, as mused by the Fox News host, as it is illustrative of why safe and legal access to abortion services are necessary, in my opinion, and why such matters should be left between individuals and their healthcare providers. Because in the enormous magnitude of this tragedy, I can't fathom why Republican legislators would stand between a healthcare provider and somebody who has experienced this enormous tragedy. Of course, the story was very fast developing. Police were alerted to the pregnancy in late June, I believe it was the 22nd, after Child Services Department received reports from the mother. The incident happened on May 12th, and then they were notified, yes, on June 22nd, and began their investigation the same day. The girl on July 6th identified the man as her assailant, Gerson Fuentes, and then on Tuesday, July 12th, the police, with a search warrant, obtained a swab of his saliva DNA, and he went to police headquarters for questioning, where he confessed to raping the minor, and his next appearance will be on July 22nd. Now, Todd Rokita wasted no time at all after verifying the story. The Republican attorney general said that his office planned to investigate the Indiana doctor that was OBGYN, Dr. Caitlin Bernard, who helped the 10-year-old rape victim who had to cross the state lines to receive the service. This is Todd Rokita on Fox News saying that he intends to investigate.
And then we have this abortion activist acting as a doctor with a history of failing to report. So we're gathering the information, we're gathering the evidence as we speak, and we're going to fight this to the end, including looking at her licensure if she failed to report. And in Indiana, it's a crime to intentionally not report.
Now, that is good. There are strict reporting requirements in both Ohio and Indiana for abortions and rape allegations, as there should be. Mandatory reporting is very important for sexual assault victims to get the justice that they need. That being said, excuse my whiplash, because literally from July 12th, we went from doubting that this 10-year-old even existed to then the next day on July 13th, launching an investigation into the abortion service provider. Okay. But that said, Dr. Caitlin Bernard did report the abortion procedure to the Indiana Department of Health on July 2nd, 2 days after it was performed, as required by the department. The doctor's report to state health officials indicates that the pregnancy was the result of the patient being abused, and the young girl had been raped earlier in May, and police were alerted to that. According to the attorney, Kathleen Delaney, representing Dr. Caitlin Bernard, she says the doctor took every appropriate action and proper action in accordance with the law in both her medical and ethical training as a physician. She also sent a cease and desist letter yesterday to the attorney general, asking him to stop making false and misleading statements about the alleged misconduct by Dr. Bernard in her profession, which constitute defamation per se. So, yes, there are a lot of lingering questions about this case, and most important of which I think is being highly overlooked is the welfare of this young 10-year-old and her ongoing safety. And that's something to be concerned about, because Telemundo caught up with the mother, who is now curiously denying that anything's wrong. She's saying that her daughter is, quote, just fine. I can't imagine how you would say that. And also claiming that the reports about this rapist are lies. So there's a shocking turn of events. This was the exchange with a reporter at her apartment, in which she had just cracked the door.
La niña vivía aquí también.
Sí, pero ella está bien. Todo lo que están diciendo en contra de él es mentira.
Ya. Y la niña, ¿usted es familiar de la niña?
Es mi hija.
Okay, so yeah, she's saying that her daughter is just fine there, but I'm not sure that you could say that's the case. She's very defensive and also claiming that she wasn't the person who reported this rapist to authorities, even though that's what testimony and court documents reveal, which is extremely curious. And also a concerning development is the fact that this apartment where they caught up to her for the interview is the same listed address as the rapist. So yes, the ongoing safety of the 10-year-old, I think, is the most pertinent fact here. And then also another fact not to be overlooked is the immigration status of the accused rapist, of course, highlighting the necessity for ordered, legitimate border control, for ordered immigration, and the fact that we have such a porous border on our south with lawlessness, which is largely abetted and aided by the Biden administration, helps contribute to ongoing tragedies like this and tragedies like the 50-person casualty from human smuggling that we saw in southern Texas a couple weeks ago. And you will continue to see more tragedies as long as the southern border remains porous. So there's lots of takeaways from this tragic story, but of course the most important factor remains the ongoing welfare of this 10-year-old. And I think one of the takeaways from this story is indeed highlighting the necessity of respecting individual rights, and those include the right to privacy and the ability to seek medical procedures between individual and their doctor. All right, a lot to cover, including coming up next, I wanted to get into the hearings that took place in Congress and in the Senate dealing with the fallout from the overturn of Roe versus Wade. Lots of testimony to get through, including a couple of entertaining exchanges with Congressman John Cornyn as well as Senator Josh Hawley. So stay tuned for that coming up next on 93 WIBC. I'm coming for your love, okay.
Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC.
Welcome back to Saturday Night on the Circle. In this segment, we're going to cover House and Senate committees that heard testimony on Tuesday and Wednesday from state officials on abortion and abortion rights activists and legal and medical experts about the impact that the Supreme Court's reversal of Roe versus Wade had in the states that have imposed limits on abortion. Again, this is Saturday Night on The Circle. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher, producer Carl on the board. And this is fortunately a slightly easier topic to discuss than the preceding segment. That said, there were a couple of entertaining exchanges between Senators Josh Hawley and Senator John Cornyn. I said congressman in the last segment. That's wrong. I was thinking of Congressman Ralph Norman of South Carolina, who also had an entertaining exchange in these hearings. We'll be getting to all three. But we begin with, of course, the most prominent one between Josh Hawley and law professor Kiera Bridges. That went viral after her hearing, in which she repeatedly referred to people with the capacity for pregnancy and then accused the Missouri senator of transphobia. She also used this term during an exchange with Senator John Cornyn of Texas, and I'll play that now.
Do you think a baby that is delivered alive has value?
Yes.
Do you think that a baby that is not yet born has value?
I believe that a person with a capacity for pregnancy has value. They have intelligence. They have agency.
I'm talking about the baby.
And I'm talking about the person with the capacity for pregnancy.
And you're not answering the question.
I'm answering a more interesting question. Do you think that
a baby that is not yet born, let's say the day before this mother delivers, do you think that baby has value?
I think that the person with the capacity for pregnancy has value, and they should have the ability to control what happens to their lives.
Well, and I just note you refuse to answer the question.
Okay, and here's what I really wanted to get into, and how Democrats love to snatch, just often foil themselves, because instead of focusing on what this is, which is women's rights, they trip over themselves with these very odd terms and phrases, very Marxist terms, people with a capacity for pregnancy. I mean, I believe we have a term for that, and we call them mothers. It's not overly complicated. It's also not a trick question to recognize that infants do, in fact, have value. They're the first part of that exchange with the senator.
Is delivered alive, has value.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, again, it's not a trick question there, but because they can't, they demand abortion on demand from conception to delivery, and that with absolutely no limitation whatsoever. And that's why that matter got brought before the Supreme Court. And that's ultimately why Roe versus Wade was overturned, because they weren't happy with safe, legal access to abortion with limits that also respect a developing life, and the fact that there is an infant that is developing, that no limitation whatsoever, they have to push it. And that was also highlighted in exchange with a congressman, there we go, of South Carolina, Ralph Norman, and Sarah Lopez, who couldn't denounce infanticide. So on the one hand, you have a law professor, and then on the other hand, you have this abortion advocate, Sarah Lopez, and neither one of them can simply denounce infanticide up to the moment of birth, which is more than slightly disturbing.
As I assume you agree with infanticide, the killing of a child, a perfectly healthy child at birth.
I don't accept the basis of that question, but I do believe abortion is health care.
It's not a trick question.
I'm talking about, do you agree? I know, I get that, but do you agree? I mean, do you support infanticide, killing the child after he's born?
I do not agree with the basis of that question.
What's
but
the
I
basis?
Do believe that abortion is health care.
Okay, so I'll take that as a yes, you do agree.
More than just saying that abortion is health care, she also testified that she's here to make, quote, "I'm here today to make sure that everyone who currently needs an abortion, who has had who has had an abortion or will need an abortion, is not alone, no matter what the state tries to force upon us." She herself had an abortion, and she said it was an act, quote, "an act of self-love," which I think is definitely an overstatement for the seriousness of the matter at hand. And then returning to this law professor, Kira Bridges, they can't even keep the subject of the matter straight, which this is, you know, a women's healthcare issue. And that's what Josh Hawley was trying to get out of this law professor. And she's instead using this Orwellian term, you know, people with a capacity for pregnancy. And it results in this exchange, which derails the entire conversation into transphobia.
Professor Bridges, you said several times, you've used a phrase, I want to make sure I understand what you mean by it. You've referred to people with a capacity for pregnancy. Would that be women?
Many women, cis women, have the capacity for pregnancy. Many cis women do not have the capacity for pregnancy. There are also trans men who are capable of pregnancy, as well as non-binary people who are capable of pregnancy.
So this isn't really a women's rights issue.
That this impacts women while also recognizing that it impacts other groups. Those things are not mutually exclusive, Senator Hawley.
Oh, so your view is that the core of this right then is about what?
So I want to recognize that your line of questioning is transphobic, and it opens up trans people to violence by not recognizing that.
Wow, you're saying that I'm opening up people to violence by asking whether or not women are the folks who can have pregnancies?
So I want to note that 1 out of 5 transgender persons have attempted suicide. So I think it's important—
Because of my line of questioning?
Because
so we can't talk about it?
Because denying that trans people exist and pretending not to know that they exist—
I'm denying
dangerous.
That trans people exist by asking
you
if you're talking
you?
About women
you?
Having pregnancies.
Do you believe that men can get pregnant?
No, I don't think moving
so you are denying that trans people exist.
And that leads to violence? Is this how you run your classroom? Are students allowed to question you?
Absolutely.
Or are they also treated like this?
Where they're told that they're
opening up people to violence.
We have a good time in my class. You should join.
I bet.
You might learn a lot.
Wow, I would learn a lot. I've learned a lot just in this exchange.
Absolutely.
Extraordinary.
Yep.
Now, I wonder how it would go in her classroom if one of her students responded to one of her questions by completely derailing the conversation and talking about something else and then saying blithely, I was talking about a question that was more interesting to me. I don't think that would fly in a classroom setting for Kiara Bridges, although she believes that flies in Senate hearings when she's being addressed. That said, it illustrates why liberals have become disconnected with this issue, because imagine seriously asserting that the restriction of abortion services would more gravely impact transsexuals than, I don't know, women. In defense of this sanitized thought, NBC published an article which breathlessly stated research suggests transgender people would be disproportionately affected by restrictions on abortion. Again, the idea that this is more impactful to transsexuals than the many millions of women across the country, I think, is frankly insulting and kind of derails the value of your assertions. That and the fact that you can't manage to draw a line in the sand anywhere and demand abortion without any limits from conception to birth, which I think is the genesis of the issue. And speaking of which, affirming a transsexual identity is not always beneficial to them. And we're finding that with a growing number of people. Not everyone is always affirmed by the transition therapy. After living for a decade of his life as a transgender woman named Brianna, Brian Wagner ultimately decided to realize his transition was a mistake. In February of this year, he detransitioned, one of a growing number of people, and he blames medical professionals for contributing to his decisions. Quote, it was basically like medical professionals were cheering on a girl with bulimia for puking up her lunch when her ribs are already poking out. He said of the estrogen treatment he was put on for years, there's a lot of money to be made by doctors. They see dollar signs, and in the end, money talks. So if this law professor wants to talk about marginalized experiences, I can't imagine a more marginalized one than from an individual who has detransitioned from an already incredibly minute community. And just to emphasize, you know, how exploitative some of those medical professionals are, after just and this is according to his testimony, after a couple therapy sessions with just one therapist, they gave a 22-year-old a referral letter to see a doctor in Hollywood who on the same day in the first session gave him a prescription for estrogen. And at the time, the therapist knew he was addicted to drugs and knew he had severe depression, but didn't go over any of it. It was just about hormones. So I would dispute some of the law professor's assertions. And again, I think it derails the abortion conversation, which presumptively would be most pertinent to women. But liberals just can't help but snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Anyway, you're listening to 93 WIBC. Stay tuned for more. Coming up next, Hat Tricks with Hatcher.
This is Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC.
I read the news today, oh boy.
On this week's edition of Hat Tricks with Hatcher, you'll hear an administration in crisis as runaway inflation blindsides the nation and squeezes those least able to afford the increase. Even CNN cast doubt on the administration's narrative that America is doing better than its international counterparts. And although these high prices are bad for you, you'll hear how the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg revels in the price increase, moving Americans to purchase electric vehicles, which, ironically, do not always live up to the low emissions benefits they advertise. And finally, we'll round off the segment with the mockworthy moment of the week when the First Lady compared Latino voters to tacos. Don't miss out on this week's edition of Hat Tricks with Hatcher.
It's time for another one of Hatcher's Hat Tricks.
The story you are about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
You're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle, where I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher. Producer Carl is on the board, and you can catch my podcast uploaded to Saturday Night on the Circle.fireside.fm. We begin with Karine Jean-Pierre, the press secretary, giving us bad news. The CPI is expected to be highly elevated, which, in fact, it was.
So on Wednesday, we will have new CPI inflation data, and we expect the headline number, which includes gas and food, to be highly elevated, mainly because gas prices were so elevated in June.
Uh-oh. Well, it turns out that was absolutely right. CPI soared to 9.1% increase from a year ago, above the 8.8% increase that the Dow Jones had estimated. That marked the fastest pace for inflation going back to November of 1981. But buckle up, because the real number to watch out for isn't the CPI, the consumer price index, but the PPI, the producer price index, and that bodes an even more worrisome forecast. Inflation hit hard at the wholesale level as producer prices surged to also record amounts from a year ago due to a big jump in energy costs, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The PPI, a measure of prices received for final demand products, increased 11.3% from a year ago, which is the highest reading since its record of 11.6% in March. The Federal Reserve officials are expected to keep pressing forward on interest rate hikes to bring inflation down closer to their longer run 2% goal. But in the meantime, we are all suffering from the effects of inflation. And what's most galling is how the administration is reveling in how it squeezes you and forces you to change your behavior. This is Pete Buttigieg extolling the virtues of electric vehicles on a podcast interview from this week.
We're for cutting the cost of electric vehicles, because when you have an electric vehicle, then you're also going to be able to save on gas, but you got to be able to afford it in the first place.
Right.
Now, we're actually starting to see on some models, the costs come to where even if the your car payment's a little higher, your gas payment will be a little lower and you come out ahead, but the prices still need to come down for most Americans to be able to get in an EV.
So the only reason why that's possible is because of the high energy prices we're experiencing right now. And so the high cost of American energy resources achieves policy goals for the administration, which the press secretary is glibly bragging about, hyping up the minuscule costs in savings, which wouldn't be nearly so pronounced were it not for the record highs in gas prices that we're experiencing. But the hype says electric vehicles are much better for the environment than their gas-powered counterparts. The math doesn't always bear that out, especially for larger electric vehicles. So the truth is more nuanced. This is according to Pete Huether. He pointed out that just because electric vehicles do not spew carbon dioxide does not mean they don't have an environmental impact. Comparing a gasoline-powered Chevy Malibu to an all-electric Hummer electric vehicle, which tips the scales at around 9,000 pounds, the Malibu actually comes out a winner in the emissions duel, with 320 grams of emissions per mile against the 341 grams per mile emitted by the Hummer EV. And that also doesn't factor in some of the manufacturing of the vehicle, the manufacturing process, the mining process to extract the minerals, and the refining of the battery. So all that needs to be factored into electric vehicles. And we also haven't seen the long-term environmental impacts of having to trade out the batteries and what they're going to do for storage and disposal and landfill. All of that ultimately lingering questions that paint the picture of electric vehicles not being the salvation that left-wing politicians are advertising them to be. And meanwhile, of course, we're continuing to deal with high cost of inflation. And the Biden administration's narrative right now is that although inflation is out of control, America is outperforming its geopolitical counterparts. And that's not necessarily true. And even members of the lamestream media are beginning to take note. Here's CNN pointing out that inflation in the USA is higher than in other developed countries, which are also facing the same factors.
The rate of inflation in the US is higher than it is in Canada, France, Italy, Japan, India, Mexico, China. Why?
Well, here's a couple of things. I mean, first off, let's be clear. The bulk of the increases in prices last month were due to energy and food, and most of that was indeed due to energy. And so this is really the result of, you know, the United States and countries everywhere coming out of a historic pandemic, where we have seen these ongoing challenges with supply chains, these fragile supply chains that businesses have created around the world that have made it difficult to get products to shelves in the time of this recovery from a pandemic. You add on top of that this unprovoked war that Putin has been waging in the Ukraine, and that is why we've seen prices rise. So these gas prices, and again, as you pointed out, this is a global phenomenon. Again, coming out of the pandemic is global, the supply chain challenges are global, and the energy challenges are also global.
Absolutely, there's no question about that, but the countries I just listed that have lower year-to-year rates of inflation at last measurements, they've all been hit by the pandemic and by energy prices as well. And I'm just trying to understand why it's a higher rate of inflation here in the United States.
And the answer to that is because of Biden administration policies, answer that is becoming all too evident to the average voter because his popularity is plummeting, even in members of his own party who say that another candidate should run for election in 2024, which is kind of galling if you think about it, for a president who hasn't even reached the midterms of his first term yet, to be so roundly denounced by both sides of the aisle. But there again, members of the mainstream media pushing back on this narrative that somehow the USA is doing better than other nations, which are also facing those same issues, you know, the ongoing war in Ukraine, supply chain shortages, et cetera, and yet are outperforming the United States when it comes to rate of inflation. And that's because of the United States monetary policy and the continuous printing of stimulus money and the fact that trillions of dollars of our money has been spent in an inordinately short amount of time, constituting some of the largest increases to national debt to date that the country has ever experienced. Finally, though, I wanted to play this soundbite from Jill Biden making a mockery of the administration. The first lady told a group of progressives in Texas that they, Hispanic voters, that they were as unique as breakfast tacos during a speech on Monday in San Antonio.
This organization, with the understanding that the diversity of this community, as distinct as the Bogotas of the Bronx, as beautiful as the blossoms of Miami, and as unique as the breakfast tacos here in San Antonio, is your strength.
Okay, so two things there. It's bodega, but also, can you imagine how insulting it would be to compare? I mean, some food items that you should never compare Latin voters to. Tacos is got to be close to the top of the list. Chimichangas would probably be another one. Don't do it. But what, of course, what this incident reminded me of was the infamous moment from Donald Trump's campaign in 2016 when he tweeted, "Happy Cinco de Mayo. The best taco bowls are made in Trump Tower Grill. I love Hispanics." That's what it reminded me of. Of course, the First Lady did ultimately apologize for that singularly insulting display, but the damage had been done. It would be like comparing Hoosiers to pork tenderloins. Don't do it. You're listening to 93 WIBC Saturday Night on the Circle. One more segment to round out the hour. Hear how a New Hampshire distillery is making a unique flavored drink from the local from the local sea life. We'll talk about that coming up next on 93 WIBC.
You're listening to Saturday Night on the Circle on 93 WIBC.
Welcome back to Saturday Night on the Circle. Carl, this whiskey sounds absolutely clawsome. I'm talking about the new Crab Trapper whiskey flavored with invasive green crabs made by a New Hampshire distillery called Tamworth Distilling, and they're partnered with the University of New Hampshire. They're a maker of craft spirits, and they're not afraid to push the boundaries of unexpected flavor and good taste. In the past, They produced whiskey with a secretion from beavers' castor sacks, which can also be used for waterproofing. Fun fact. Last year, they had turkey whiskey over the holidays before the notoriously pungent smell of durian invaded the flavor of their whiskey. And now they are using invasive green crabs. These crabs can be caught off the coast of New Hampshire, and they're taken to the distillery where they're boiled to produce a stout crab broth. The broth is fortified with alcohol and then goes through a distillation process which separates out the funky smells of the crab from the more inviting aromas. I'm not sure fishy and alcohol goes together, but okay. The company said the body of this brew has hints of maple, vanilla oak, clove, cinnamon, and allspice, which is a generous description for crab, none of which I think tastes like that. The crabs came over from ships in Europe in the mid-1800s and landed on Cape Cod, an invasive species. They've taken the region by storm. Their saucer-sized crustaceans, murky green in color, decimating the area's marine ecosystem, outcompeting native species for food and shelter. The crabs are so numerous, they've usually really impacted native shellfish habitats and fisheries because they're also voracious predators, most impacting the softshell crab fishery, a clam fishery, which has suffered millions of dollars in losses due to the species. I also wanted to cover a story. This comes from November of 2021, but I've never been more grateful to be an American than after reading about the Aswan scorpion invasion in Egypt. No nightmares like that in the land of the free, fortunately. The Aswan scorpion invasion came in November of 2021 when the region had been flooded, and then heavy rains followed dust storms, which disturbed scorpions' nest, resulting in more than 500 stings. Doctors had to be called off of vacations. Thousands of scorpions invaded neighborhoods and came into their homes because their nests were disturbed. And the only question that I have, especially after the first story, is I wonder how scorpion whiskey would taste. I guess the distillers of Egypt will have to find out. You're listening to 93 WIBC. More content to come. Stay tuned to Hour 2, where I interview Secretary of State candidate Jeff Maurer.
It's the time of the season when love runs high.
You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIBC.
Welcome back to Saturday Night on The Circle. If you missed the first hour, we had lots of exciting conversations, including the developing story about the 10-year-old rape victim who received abortion services in the state of Indiana, the hearings in the House and the Senate regarding the fallout from the overturn of Roe versus Wade, as well as the moment the First Lady called Hispanic voters in San Antonio and compared them to breakfast tacos. If you missed any of that, catch the podcast uploaded to Saturday Night on The Circle.fireside.fm, Saturday Night on The Circle.fireside.fm. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher. That's producer Carl. Beep, 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 pushing those buttons, doing the things to make the show work. And we begin this hour with the Biden administration at the helm of a sinking ship, with fewer Americans than ever before expressing confidence in the administration and his ability to run for a second term. This, according to a Yahoo News YouGov poll, which revealed just 18% of Americans said that the president should run for re-election in 2024, the lowest number to date. Two-thirds, 64%, said he should bow out. And for the first time, more Democrats now say Biden should pass on a second term, 41%, than those who said he should pursue it, 35%. The survey of 1,600 U.S. adults, which was conducted from July 8th to 11th, represents the starkest evidence to date that the president's deteriorating position with voters, including those of his own party. Since late May, the number of Americans who say Biden should run for re-election has fallen by 7 points. Among Democrats, that number has fallen by 8. Meanwhile, when asked who they would rather see as the Democratic nominee for president in 2024, only a quarter of Democrats and Democratic leaning independents say Biden, and fewer said Vice President Kamala Harris. More, 20%, said that they should pick someone else. which is kind of sad, and 30% were not sure. No U.S. president has declined to run for re-election since Democrat Lyndon B. Johnson in 1968, so 2024 could be a pivotal moment in American political history should Biden choose not to run. He's repeatedly insisted, though, both publicly and privately, that he will continue to compete for a second term, but the confidence in his administration certainly is lacking, although not for lack of attempting to project it. Here is Karine Jean-Pierre being called on the lack of popularity, and she said that polls go up and they go down.
What was the president's response to a new poll from the New York Times today showing that 64% of Democrats say that they would prefer a different candidate in 2024?
And I would also say from that very same poll, there were 92% of Democrats who support this president as well. Look, you know, not to get into politics from here or get into any political analysis. This is not something, there's going to be many polls. They're going to go up or they're going to go down. This is not the thing that we are solely focused on.
The polls, they go up and they go down. That was conducted by the New York Times, but it closely mirrors the YouGov poll and the Yahoo News poll, though that's not scientific. Also, 64% of that poll said that the president should bow out. So yes, it seems that, it wasn't 92% of Democrats support the president. Less than 70% of voters, in fact, support the president. So yeah, of Democrat voters support the president, which is important to note. So this administration is helming a sinking ship, and it's clear to see why when it comes to the supply chain crisis, when it comes to the baby formula shortage, which continues to affect store shelves. I was just at a Walmart the other day, and the formula was nearly empty. And that continues to remain the case around us in states around the country. The out of control inflation, the gasoline prices, and the blithe dismissiveness of the administration, who encourages you to go buy a more expensive electric vehicle to save money temporarily on the increase in gasoline prices. When it comes to the withdrawal from Afghanistan, when it comes to the fact that this president promised he would, quote, shut down COVID. And there continues to be rising deaths, and the administration never got a handle on the pandemic. So, really, what can you point to this administration as a success story? And shockingly little, which is why supporters are fleeing the president's side in droves. And you can also see evidence of that in his dithering response to the war in Ukraine. We just sent last week another $400 million in military equipment to Ukraine, including four more advanced rocket systems. But we have no objective in the conflict in Ukraine. We have no end game. We have no tangible goals. And now the president is promising that we could be entrenched there for years to come, much like the conflict that we just got out of in Afghanistan.
How long is this going to last? How long is this onslaught going to last?
His onslaught. As long as it's going to take, when we're there till it takes whatever time it takes, we cannot let him prevail.
It can take months. It can take years.
It could.
Mm-hmm. You think the war could take years to end?
No, you said that.
Yeah,
you said
okay.
It could, okay?
It could.
No, it could.
So the United States foreign policy has literally learned nothing from the disasters of the past. That was the issue once we involved ourselves in Afghanistan. There was no victory. There was no goal for victory. There was no objective that could attainable, articulable objective that would precipitate our withdrawal from the region. And ultimately, when the withdrawal happened, it was half-baked and poorly executed. And that is the responsibility of our current executive in all, the Oval Office, President Joe Biden. So yeah, and then now, of course, a subsequent from that withdrawal, again involving us in an endless military conflict in Ukraine, which initially I was supportive of. I think that Russia should be repudiated, but this half-assed dithering of the United States, where it's a lukewarm, tepid response, it's not a full-on involvement, that's unsustainable, especially when we're already printing out trillions of dollars and on a crash course for even higher rates of inflation. We can't afford the extra billions of dollars in foreign aid when our country is already facing its own significant issues. And the Biden administration losing touch with voters and also beating back the death from a thousand cuts that continue to come from the now legitimized Biden laptop. More viral footage being leaked earlier in the week of Hunter weighing his crack cocaine. I think it's interesting that the Washington Examiner journalist who had a copy of the drive said that he was a prolific self-documentarian. There's years worth of this content, and much of it incriminating and damning for the immediate family member of the president, illustrative of the corruption surrounding that family when Biden, of course, sponsored the 1994 crime bill that was responsible for putting thousands of people in jail for drug crimes while giving his own troubled son a pass due to the connections offered by his name. Here's a son Hunter weighing out his crack in the since published viral video.
So I just weighed out the bag. It's 2.06.
2.07 without the bag.
So how long is that?
2.0.
And it just never ceases to amaze me that we have come full circle from what once had been labeled by 50 prominent intelligence officials as, quote, Russian disinformation, now being legitimized by the paper of record, the New York Times, verifying the veracity of this laptop, which had been dropped off to a Delaware computer repair shop and forgotten by the troubled son of the president, who, for reasons unknown, documented himself prolifically engaging in criminal activity. Activity and talking about the payoffs to the Biden family and his corrupt misdeeds, of which we will be finding out more ahead of the 2024 election and during the 2022 midterms, and hopefully that will have an impact on the voting public. That being said, we've got a lot more to cover, so stay tuned to 93 WIBC. Further mystery surrounds the Georgia Guidestones after they exploded. I'll tell you about a surprising discovery made at the site coming up next on 93 WIBC. Welcome back to Saturday Night on The Circle. In this segment, I wanted to talk about the Georgia Guidestones, of course, that were exploded by surprise, and the surprising discovery made there. But stay tuned, because coming up in the next segment, I'm going to be interviewing, or playing back my interview, I should say, with Libertarian Secretary of State candidate Jeff Moore. I had on Tony Katz Today earlier in the week. But anyway, want to get into the Georgia Guidestones. So referred to as America's Stonehenge since they've been erected, the granite pillars were put in place in 1980 by a secretive group of people who believed that societal collapse from nuclear war was imminent, and the Guidestones were needed to preserve aspects of humanity for generations in the future. In addition to the inscriptions offering advice for those future humans, at the bottom was an inscription that said, placed 6 feet below this spot on blank, should be opened on blank. They never decided to even fill in the inscription, but they decided to dig up after the Guidestones were exploded, and they found this time capsule, indeed, where it was stated to be 6 feet below the monument, and contained inside were a copy of Playboy, an 8-track tape of Saturday Night Fever, and a bag of 1,000 Quaaludes. So we're not really sure what that group was up to in the 1980s, but the Quaaludes may indicate some of the interesting musings offered on the Guidestones themselves. Also wanted to talk about in 1 hour,
this one gas station in Mishawaka has done more to help Hoosiers affected by high gas prices than the entire Indiana Republican Party or Governor Hightax Holcomb himself. This was on a news report by WDRB.
An Indiana gas station gives some drivers a bit of a break, offering discounted prices.
Like, we were using majority of our paychecks just to afford gas, and now just to have this, is, I can tell you, this has done amazing things just for me.
Me too. Plus, I mean, it helps far on the grocery bill too, because you can take what I was going to spend today, and I was going to the grocery store anyway, so it kind of helps out too. So, I mean, I really appreciate them for doing this.
Absolutely.
The gas station in Mishawaka offered a discounted price of $2.38 a gallon for an hour and a half yesterday. The program was held by Americans for Prosperity in Indiana. The average price of gas in Indiana yesterday was $4.87 a gallon.
Yeah, it was only for an hour, but still more than the entirety of the Indiana Republican Party has done to alleviate the cost of rising gas prices on Hoosiers in the state, which is kind of disgusting when you think about it. But kudos to that gas station for offering a little bit of community service to their patrons. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. Coming up in the next segment, I'm going to replay my interview with Jeff Moore, candidate for Secretary of State of the Libertarian Party here in Indiana. I talked with him on Tony Katz Today. It was an interesting conversation. I'm sure you'll find it worthwhile. Stay tuned for that on Saturday night on The Circle.
You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIPC.
Welcome back to Saturday Night on The Circle. Wrapping things up on a busy Saturday evening here in the Circle City. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher. If you missed a moment of my program, catch the podcast uploaded to SaturdayNightOnTheCircle.fireside.fm. Again, SaturdayNightOnTheCircle.fireside.fm. This week, I had the enormous privilege and pleasure to fill in for Tony Katz on the afternoon show, Tony Katz Today. I was with my friend and colleague, the talented host, writer, and stuntman extraordinaire. You know him, you love him, as the gentleman from Georgia, the Brian Baker. We had a lot of worthwhile conversations, but one of the most interesting discussions I thought we shared was with the Libertarian Secretary of State candidate for Indiana, Jeff Moore. I thought this was a worthwhile conversation because of the unique opportunity that this presents the Libertarian Party in the state of Indiana to further their goals. Because although victory is and always remains the primary objective, a subsidiary goal of this election is to get the candidate across the 10% voting threshold and thereby grant the Libertarian Party access to nominate their candidates via the primary election process. And that in and of itself would grant the party an enormous boon as a viable third alternative to the current two-party duopoly system.
Yes, that's all true. But let's take a step back and see the bigger picture here. Elections are how we as a civil society agree to disagree. And if we don't have election results that we trust, we can't trust our elected officials. So getting the elections right is critical to our civil society, and getting 10% as a third party, any third party, the Save the Whales party, it doesn't matter, is critical for advancing those issues. So here in Indiana, as libertarians who want to see more limited government and who want to live more freely, we want to get across 10% so that way our libertarian candidates can indeed take advantage of the same advantages that Republicans and Democrats have enjoyed as a monopoly for years.
Okay, so one of the things... go ahead, Brian.
Go ahead, Ethan. You've got a good question.
Oh, I was going to say, so you're bringing up election integrity as part of your platform, and that's what I'm seeing on the website. Like, one of the things you're proposing is to get a receipt for your vote. I think it's an interesting concept, but doesn't that defeat the purpose of a secret ballot here in American politics?
So the secrecy of our ballot is paramount, and I'm not endangering that in any way, shape, or form, nor suggesting that we do. In fact, just the opposite. The receipt is like a tariff code at the bottom of your dry cleaning or any number of other things. Arizona is working with a ballot that's similar. Even a church raffle ticket, you tear it in half, you keep one, one goes into the jar. The church doesn't know who won the bag of fish or whatever it is that was being raffled off. So we can maintain the secrecy of it, but you can still have that receipt need to verify yourself independently that your vote was received, your vote was counted, and your vote was audited. And the receipt is half the project, half the problem and half the solution. So the receipt, the other half of the receipt, is a complete audit of all 92 counties. The receipt tells you that your vote was in, but the audit tells you that no other votes that weren't supposed to be voted were included as well. So that way there aren't 30,000 dead people suddenly and mysteriously voting. And currently in Indiana, we audit only 5 out of 92 counties. It's not clear how those counties are chosen. It's not clear that all the races within those counties are audited. And remember, we only have 40% of all votes in the state with any kind of paper backup. So first of all, we're only auditing less than half the votes. And then we're only auditing nearly less than 5% of the counties. And then the results of those audits are secret. They're not published. You can't see it. It's just an empty promise that these elections are audited. We don't know what's in the thing. And it reminds me a whole lot about 2008 and all the financial gimmicks that were happening then. So what we really need is a complete and independent audit of our of all 92 counties. And we need that done before the elections are actually certified. Also, the organization VSTOP that audits the elections, part of Allstate, but answers to the Secretary of State. So you can't be surprised when their audit results come back and say, we did an amazing job, because that's their boss.
So let's say there is a problem that's discovered as well, Jeff. I mean, if somebody has cast their ballot, there's shenanigans going on, then what would be the process for them to actually get something like that, you know, get attention to that and then get the situation rectified?
It's a good question, and we really haven't had to wrestle with that as a state yet. But in my heart of hearts, I believe that our elections are safe. I believe that there are areas that are absolutely vulnerable and that we have to do everything that we can to actually address and correct and make those areas less vulnerable. And that's what the audit will tell us. But if it's worse than that, and it might be, we need to understand what the problems are before we can fix it. We can't fix the problem if we don't even recognize that it is a problem.
And is the areas of vulnerability, is that just due to the fact that there's nobody minding the store and they know that there's not a second set of eyes that is going over this and checking it and verifying all of these things, all these votes?
That's part of it. I mean, there are many different areas of vulnerability to any election. I've been recommending that Hoosiers vote on election day in person. Mail-in voting has the pros of convenience, but the cons of security. Think about all the mail pieces, checks that you're expecting the mail, things that just don't get delivered and get lost. And that's just one area of vulnerability. You can order or request print disabled ballots without seemingly any kind of check against the voter registration roll right now. We've got similar inconsistencies with felons who are currently incarcerated or haven't yet served their time. So we just don't know that the voter rolls are correct. And then there's, as you know, Diego Morales is the Republican candidate for Secretary of State, and he is advocating for increased security to ensure that there are not non-U.S. citizens who are voting. So there are all these areas of vulnerability, and even just having current addresses to verify voters. People move between counties, between states, between within counties even. And one thing that I would love to see is that we compare our voter rolls against Indiana Department of Revenue data to see that at least within the last year, you're the same person at the same address.
You're listening to Tony Katz Today. I'm your host, Ethan Hatcher, joined by Naptown Brian Baker. Together, we're talking with Libertarian candidate for Secretary of State here in Indiana, Jeff Maurer. And we've been discussing the proposal to get receipts for your vote in order to help maintain election integrity. And the question that I want to ask you, Jeff, is how would this potential audit be enacted if you're setting up this system of receipts? We're talking about an enormous amount of data that would have to be stored and verified. Are we doing that electronically, manually, or some combination of both?
I don't have all the answers, and that's going to come with conversations with legal, with cybersecurity, with both parties, and all three parties that are in power in the state. So it's not for me alone to decide this, but I think the answer is going to be somewhere in the middle, and it's going to involve all of those. It's going to involve a digital solution, digital electronic solution that's going to give us the immediacy and accuracy with a paper backup that gives us the confidence of it. And that's really the sweet spot, the compromise of a digital, primarily digital electronic solution with paper backup.
Yeah, the security and integrity of our elections is paramount. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, Jeff, a small business is obviously the backbone of America, and certainly the backbone of the Hoosier economy. I know that's one of the things that you're really pushing for, is trying to eliminate some of the roadblocks for small businesses, especially startups, to get up and running. What are some things, some changes that you'd like to see take place? And certainly if you're elected, what are some things that you're going to be pushing for on that front?
Sure. So I had the pleasure of being in a town hall recently and asked everybody in the room to raise your hands if you've actually ever started a business here in Indiana. And among the many candidates who were on the stage, there was only my hand went up with, I think, one or two others. And of course, there were 20 or 30 people in the room who also had small businesses. And as small business owners, we know that we're focused on our product, our services, our clients, our competition, our cash flow, our employees, our payroll. There's a million things that worry us. But thinking about how the government can help us is not one of those. So as a libertarian, I want minimal government. I want limited government that serves we the people, that serves its constituents. And so as Secretary of State, it's a great office to actually serve small businesses. I could point to Republicans who talk and have said for long, many years, that they support business. But in practice, those are really supporting large corporations that pay handsomely into into political development. And so what I'm talking about is supporting somebody fundamentally different, supporting the small business entrepreneur, the Hoosier who's starting a business and growing it right here, not bringing it in from out of state, but growing a business here. And it's challenging. And I've started a business and I founded it in Indiana. I filed with the Secretary of State's office years ago, and it's not easy. So we can expand service hours. We can make it easier. We can have go kits and say that if you're starting in this industry or starting this type of business, you might want services like this, or expect to need to speak with these agencies, or expect to need these certifications. The most important thing we can do is get government out of the way of entrepreneurs so they can create businesses, serve their customers, create value, create jobs.
So, I mean, in terms of practically what that looks like, is it just a matter of getting them better guidance and information about how to go about making that process happen? Or are there regulatory issues that are in place at this point in time that are making it difficult for would-be entrepreneurs to get their businesses up and running in the state of Indiana?
It's a combination of both. So first is to simplify and lessen the regulatory burdens. And as Secretary of State, I can go to the General Assembly and say, we don't need this form, or this form is redundant. This process is redundant. You already get this information over here. Let's eliminate this burden. And that's the type of thing that we can streamline and simplify, so that makes it easier for entrepreneurs to start businesses. On the other side, or until that happens, I can work directly with businesses and say, all right, these are the things that we have to do. Until that changes, we're going to make this easier. We're going to simplify it. We're going to put together all the documents in one place. We're going to give better explanation. There's YouTube videos on it. Or make it easier so that you don't need to hire a lawyer for it. Expand customer service options, text, email, hours. Think about the ways that if we were running this as a business, we would seek to serve our customer better. And that's the pro-business mentality that I will bring to the office.
Excellent.
You're listening to 93 WIBC. Before we go, Jeff, there's one thing that I wanted to note, and that's, of course, there's an enormous amount of dissatisfaction right now with the Republican Party here in the state of Indiana, and that bodes well for your prospects in election. It certainly provided an enormous boost to Governor Rainwater's campaign when he was attempting to win election just this last cycle. But that being said, one of the drums that Republicans frequently like to beat is this fear of an abortion factory on every corner, and now that Roe versus Wade has been overturned, that debate will be returning front and center to the Indiana legislative debate here. So how do you propose to overcome those headwinds and obtain success in the election?
It's a great question. And as a libertarian, I do believe in limited government that stays within its lane. And the Secretary of State's office just does not intersect with this issue. So where it does have a say, or where it can be a help, is one of the things that I'm championing in my candidacy here, and that's for recall, referenda, and ballot initiatives. So whatever the issue, whether it's abortion or inflation and runaway government spending, and I've been on the campaign trail a lot with James Siniak, who is the Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate, running against Todd Young. And one of the things he points out is that Todd Young has spent more in the Senate than somebody named Bernie Sanders. And that is just abysmal for somebody who has an R after his name. So one of the things that I want to champion is recall and referendum ballot initiative. And that gives us, we the people, tools to directly control the bloated government that is over us and refuses to answer us, sometimes even refuses to appear on video. So if we use the tool of recall, we can say that there is a sitting senator or a sitting governor who does something that we don't like. They spend too much or they sign the bill the wrong way, whether it's guns or abortions or spending. It doesn't matter the issue. The tool is recall, and we can get together with our neighbors. We can get signatures and we can recall that person from office. That way they don't count on, they cannot count on 2, 4, 6 years later when we're supposed to remember how they disserved us, how they lied to us, and how much we wanted them out of office back then. We have immediate and urgent recourse, and that will force our elected officials to be more responsive to we the people.
Yeah, the politicians have grown entirely too complacent with the safety that incumbency offers, and expanding recall election might whip them into shape. So I like that idea. And you got my vote, Jeff. I will definitely be supporting your cause in the fall and hoping you get across that 10% threshold.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your support. Obviously, the 10% is critical to having more voices in your elections and in your public offices, not just this year, but in all the years forward. So I appreciate everyone's support. Certainly, you can learn more at my campaign website, moreforindiana.com. That's M-A-U-R-E-R forindiana.com.
You heard it here, 93 WIBC. That's Jeff Moore for Indiana, the Libertarian candidate. Thanks for taking time out of your schedule and talking with us today.
Thanks, Jeff.
It's my delight. Thank you so much.
That was the Libertarian candidate for Secretary of State here in Indiana, Jeff Moore, a conversation we shared on Tony Katz today. If you missed the episode, find the podcast and the rest of it uploaded to SaturdayNightOnTheCircle.fireside.fm. And stay tuned. We got one more segment to go.
I'm afraid exposure is the only answer. It's the opinion of the entire staff that Dexter is criminally insane.
You're listening to Saturday Night on The Circle on 93 WIBC.
That boy needs therapy. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Hosting this program to a close. Thanks for spending your Saturday evening with me, your humble host, Ethan Hatcher, on this exciting edition of Saturday Night on The Circle. And if you missed a moment of the program, catch my podcast uploaded to SaturdayNightOnTheCircle.fireside.fm for your retrospective entertainment and enlightenment. It can all be found on SaturdayNightOnTheCircle.fireside.fm. Now, before I coasted this program to a close, I wanted to turn our attention to the inimitable talent and entertainer extraordinaire. You know him, you may love him, you may loathe him, but you definitely recognize the one and only Alex Jones. What could be said about the man? I mean, he's quite a character, and he's utterly dramatic and ridiculous all at the same time. Last week's edition of the show on Sunday took quite an alarming and dramatic turn into the territory of self-harm, in which Alex Jones was bragging about the connection he shares with his audience, and in so doing, threatened to cut off his finger. What a nutcase.
And Lee got to direct me so that I can continue this operation, because we have been given nothing but success, nothing but victory. It has been spectacular. And you, the viewers and listeners, you did this. And that's why when I salute you, I'm not into self-harming, but I just archetypally want to take this dagger.
What?
And just cut a finger off right on air to show you
what?
How much I appreciate you and what you've done.
What?
Because giving up a finger to beat these people's nothing.
What? What is this? Oh, my God.
You have changed the world. You have stood up against evil.
Oh, my goodness.
You have turned the tide. And I salute you, and I thank you. And you've got that from the very bottom of my heart. You've got my full commitment, because you need to know in the universe there are real people. You need to know in the universe there's people like you who aren't evil, who don't serve Satan. That's why they all day say I'm an actor, all day say I'm a fake, all day say I'm a fraud with no evidence. I mean, because they know I didn't sell out to them.
I mean, I guess what can you say other than Alex Jones is apparently the Vincent Van Gogh of radio, threatening to cut off not an ear, but a finger for the loyalty of his listeners. Absolutely ridiculous. But truly, I wanted to play the sound clip because it's an excellent segue and an excuse to the greatest songify ever constructed. Alex Jones is a Bon Iver's indie folk song. Listen and enjoy.
The paradigm of absolute control. And that's why we're just out here doing simple things, pointing out that we're meant to be in nature and be natural. And this is where we find the source that God made to transcend the new world order. And that's why they want to try to keep us out of it.
I'm angry. I've had enough of these people. Little bones of Christian murder, scum, metal and giant death factories keeping babies alive. Selling that body part. What more do you need to know about these people? I go out and face this storm. They literally crawl out from under rocks. They have green looking skin and they run around screaming, we love Satan, we wanna eat babies. I have them on video. Hillary's in the creepy weird sick stuff, man. She sleeps in the same room with that creepy weirdo woman whose mother wears a hood over her head.
What the hell?
That woman number one is ugly. Imagine how bad she smells, man. I'm told her and Obama just stink. Obama and Hillary both smell like sulfur. Vampire pot, then the goblins hobbling round, coming after us. My spirit gets close to that evil, and I feel it go.
We're such self-centered crap. We don't even notice, and it's self rising up against us.
Millions upon it, people of the very worst type, and I'm so pissed. Gonna stab your daughter at the mall.
Oh, oh, oh.
We're gonna stab your wife, your son.
Ooh.
We're gonna stab you with a butcher knife. And then the police chief is gonna say, we love our Somalis. We love our Muslims. Oh, they're so good.
Oh, my God. Oh, that brings a smile to my face every time I listen to it. If you're just tuning in again, that was the Alex Jones Songify, the greatest parody ever constructed, wholly 100% from transcripts on The Alex Jones Show. And of course, you can find it on YouTube if you enjoyed listening. It's one of my favorite parodies ever, and I hope you loved it as well. Unfortunately, that brings this week's edition of the show to a close. Thanks for spending this Saturday night with me, your host, Ethan Hatcher. And I leave you with my parting words of wisdom. As always, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, whoever you're with, remember that life is a state of mind. And I'll see you next week on 93 WIBC.